On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a ratio. Okay, though. It's a ratio. Okay, though.
I wonder if there's a moment you can think about where you were scared for your spirit or for your body.
Like, yes. I guess two times. One was three drones over my car following me home in Louisville, Kentucky, calling several people trying to track down the police chief or someone in the police department who knows why the hell these drones are following us because we're not doing anything wrong. And having the representatives of the chief call back and say, we're not following you. Those are not our drones. We don't know who they are, but you need to get to safety, right? Because we can't control, we don't know. I have no idea who was following me. And that's happened so many times. And then it just got to the point where they just became like, I walk out the house that I was staying in for 4 months in Louisville and the drone would be over the house and we'd just be like, hey, you know, and then that was it. But in the beginning, it was really, really scary. And I can't say that I'm comfortable with it, but it's nothing I can do, right? And then the other time that was really scary for me was walking with, you know, Rachel Nordlinger, obviously.
Yeah.
Dear friend and sister. And walking into that rehab where she took me and dropped me off, I was definitely scared. I was like, wait, we're in deep here. Like, this is serious. When she left, I was, you know, it was me against my addiction. And that was definitely scary because I didn't know, you know, how I would come out of that. I beat it just the same way, you know, we continue to beat so many different circumstances as Black folks, but it wasn't an easy thing to do.
Tamika Mallory is a lion. She's an activist. She's one of the most important people on the front lines of the Black liberation struggle right now. She's the author of the new book, State of Emergency. We're going to talk about defunding the police. We're going to talk about the war on drugs. We're going to talk about justice and voting and what getting free really means. I love Tamika. I'm happy to have her back on the show to listen to half of this very important, timely interview. Stay right here. But for the whole thing, go to patreon.com/Touré Show. For $5 a month, you'll get the 60-minute version of our Wednesday shows, plus our 4 Friday Patreon exclusives, and you get to help support our growing show. Let's dig into it. It's Tamika Mallory on Touré Show. Congrats on the book.
Thank you, sir.
Very excited. How is your spirit? Because, you know, every time somebody is dead and the family is grieving and you are there supporting them and lifting them up and trying to hold folks accountable. And I wonder just how does this land on your spirit that you're always there, like lifting folks up when they're in their lowest moment?
You know, I don't know. I have my moments and I have families that I'm really close to. And I think it gets harder after, like when we're in the midst of the fight, I can deal with it because I'm used to that. But it gets harder when they're struggling after people are gone, after the cameras are gone. It's just like any other grieving process. You know, it does get a little difficult. And I don't know. One of the things I stopped doing is watching videos. I stopped that. I don't watch videos. I have not watched the full video of Ronald Green. If I see an image, I go away from it quickly. I only watched George Floyd's video because of the trial. You know, at that point, it was like if you were into the trial, you couldn't miss all the little pieces. But I never sat down and watched the full video.
So why? Because I struggle with watching new ones, and I try to avoid it unless like the world is like, yo, you got to see this one, and I feel guilty for not watching. But why do you make a choice?
It's super duper preventative. Like I just can't. I mean, I was waking up at night holding on to images and sounds and other things. It wasn't good for me. And I think, you know, maybe you don't know, but, you know, I had a whole struggle with pain pills and had to go to rehab and all of that. And it happened as a result of like five different traumatic things happening all at the same time. The Women's March, you know, the struggles with all the folks that I work with and just my own issues. It was so much happening. And the next thing you know, I was addicted. So, you know, I had to cut certain people and things out. And one of them, unfortunately, was working every day with white women, especially white women who are not like, have not already processed and sort of done the work. I had to stop that because it's way too abusive. It's dangerous for your mental health. So that I did. I cut out, you know, other folks that needed to just go. And then, you know, the last thing was limiting the amount of imagery that I watched with people dying. It's just too much.
And I think I'm an average black person in the notion that you could probably say about 25 names and I could immediately call up images in my short-term memory. Maybe I could get to 30. And I don't think I'm special in terms of the folks, you and the folks who are listening, of 25, 30 videos that I could name off the top of my head. And I don't think white people walk around with black images in their head. Maybe they see George Floyd, but they don't walk around with it. But we got 25, 30 that we could think of. What, I mean, like the pain that puts on us that we have all these black snuff films in our head.
But see, you're talking about 25 or 30 that the world ultimately saw, and you are one of many. What I'm saying is that every day I get four or five different clips of things sent to my phone, sent to my DMs that never make it to the world where people are trying to get their stories told. And it's not just the images of people being killed by police. I also get a lot of prison videos showing people dying, fighting, cutting, hanging, you know, sick in their cells, COVID, during COVID. Oh man, the amount of videos that I had to watch of, you know, and I didn't watch them, but, you know, people sending me stuff showing how on entire wards were full of sick people and just bowels and like a lot of stuff. So people are crying out for help and they think, you know, if I give this to you, then you could go do something with it. And a lot of times we try, but there's so much we can't do. And that I think is probably what impacts me the most is that when I lay down, it's not so much the gory nature of the video. That's not the issue. The issue for me is that I'm trying to think, what do I do? And now I'm failing this family because I can't do it. And then an anxiety, and it's just too much. So I had to stop.
So the stories are pulling you in. It's not that Tamika goes and shows up. It's that people are reaching out to you and you're like, I can't say no to you. I got to show
Absolutely. Up. Absolutely. I mean, you have that. You have people who ask me to help. Makaya Bryant was one of those situations where, 16 years old, you know, the story in Columbus, Ohio. And, you know, I saw it and I put some things out saying that, you know, I was my heart was broken for her. Yes, she had a knife. You know, I made sure to, try to not so much defend her, but just to explain how problematic it is for us to all of a sudden understand the same police department that killed her has also killed a 13-year-old, a 15-year-old, a 21-year-old, a man in his garage, another man. So this is an issue that this police department has in general. And I was doing the work of trying to explain that. But I could have gone on and said, okay, that's, you know, the end of it. It's nothing more. But then I just started getting calls from folks like, help, help, you know, they need more attention to this situation. So then that caused me to go to the funeral. So, you know, people don't understand how it all kind of happens. I rarely call a family and reach out to them and say, oh, you know, can I help you? It's very rare. It's very, very rare. Sometimes I'll see things and I notice that the situation is not getting enough attention. And I understand that if I help and use my platform, that it probably will grow, you know, in terms of folks, you know, paying attention to it. So sometimes, but that's like, if I've worked on 100 situations, that probably has been 3 or 4 times, literally.
Let's talk about Micaiah briefly in specific, because I never saw white people, especially white people on the right, saying Black Lives Matter more than with her. Because they're like, well, look, she was about to knife somebody. So she had to die. He had to kill her because, you know, don't you care about Black life? She was about to murder a Black woman. Like, look at the pink sweatsuit. She's about to die. And I'm like, really? But how do we... I mean, like, you know, there are no perfect victims, okay?
Well, there are.
Except for Breonna Taylor, right, who was sleeping. But, well, like,
But then again, she wasn't perfect because she had an ex-boyfriend, remember? So it was like, there's no such thing.
What do you say to further explain, because since you know the story inside and out, the sister was about to stab this girl, right? So what are we to make of the situation? We see other situations where people are about to stab and shoot people and the police don't shoot them when they're white. But what do we make of this situation?
What I make of it is that every single day, Tori, I work with Erica Ford, A.T. Mitchell out in Brooklyn, Shanduke McFadder. I work with Pastor Mike McBride. These are people who do anti-violence work all the time. And by the way, social workers, teachers were contacting me saying, I've been in similar, if not worse, situations where there were literal mobs and I didn't have a gun. And somehow or another, I was able to tackle, talk down, do whatever needs to be done to get a knife or even a gun out of the hands of a young person, right? And so for me, what type of training does the teacher have? What type of training does the social worker have? What type of training does Erica Ford and others who work in the street every day dealing with these issues, what type of training do they have that police officers don't? Because then that's what we need. So when I hear people like, you know, Joe Biden saying, President Biden saying that he wants to put $300 million into police, and of course, I am vehemently against that. I think we need to defund police. But if we are going to train them, then perhaps they need to be trained by people like Erica Ford, right? Who does amazing anti-violence work in New York and across the country. Maybe they need to be trained by somebody like Deepak Chopra or something. I don't know. But they need a different, it's something wrong. They definitely should not be being trained by the IDF. Is it the IDF? Yeah, the IDF in Israel. They definitely should not go there, which they do. Police officers from America travel to Israel and they work together with the police department there or whatever in the military and they get trained. That's what we should get away from, you know, because Micaiah Bryant, in my judgment, first of all, understand it. And the training is not about just the moment of violence or the moment of a reaction or whatever, the incident. They probably, being Erica Ford's, you know, the network of crisis management folks in New York, they would have known that this situation at this foster care was happening already. So I'm talking about, you know, work that would have been done because Micaiah complained to people. She told folks that there were grown women who were attacking her and she was uncomfortable. She told people that. So in most situations, with, you know, when you work with these types of programs and this is what they have resources to do and it's their job and they do it every day, that's what they know. They have intel about what's going on with the young people. And they are able to get involved and try to deal with these situations before someone even has a knife in their hands. And I think that that's, you know, that's why I say we need to defund police, because when you shift resources to more folks who do that work, I think that's when we have less need for police contacting communities.
Michelle Obama is one of the most inspiring, intelligent, graceful, unapologetically Black people that I could think of. Just her existing makes me happy, makes me feel inspired, makes me want to be a little bit more like her every day, because she seems to be just this extraordinary person. So if there's any sort of podcast about her, I want to listen to that. Life Kit from NPR has a whole episode on Michelle Obama. It's part of their whole Black Stories, Black Truths collection, where you'll hear stories of Black joy, Black resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account of what it means to be Black today from a unique Black perspective. There's a Code Switch episode about Dr. King, and I love Code Switch. There's It's Been a Minute about Eric Andre, who I love. We are not the same person, even though a lot of people think we look alike, even though he lives in my neighborhood now. But stop telling him he looks like me. Stop telling me I look like him. There's a Pop Culture Happy Hour about the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. I loved that show. That show meant so much to me. This is what Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR is all about. Stories about Black America and Black culture. Whole Pop Culture Happy Hour on Abbott Elementary, which is another amazing modern Black show. From Megan Thee Stallion to the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air to the women behind the Montgomery bus boycott to the Color Purple, the stories of Black Stories, Black Truths will take you inside the Black community and Black culture. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel about a young Black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man in America. Colm McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming-of-age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book, available wherever books are sold.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First. Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
Well, let's talk about defund, because it's a big part of your book, State of Emergency. A big topic of conversation over the last 12 months. There's some of us who believe we can better use our tax dollars. Why are we spending New York City $6 billion, more than 50% of New York City's budget? 52 cents out of every dollar I paid in New York City goes to the fucking police. Right. LAPD, I think, is $3 billion.
It's more than several departments in terms of the health department, housing, education, when you combine those budgets, it does not total the amount that the police department is receiving.
And yet even folks on the left are like, defund, I don't know, you've gone too far. Well, who would I call when black people attack me? All these different things. Your slogan is frightening. Can we just reform? Yeah. And I was actually, I think it's been about 13 months ago, I would have been like, let's reform. And I think around George Floyd, I was like, reform is impossible. It's not working. And seeing the way that the police responded last year to us saying, hey, can we have some reform? And they were like, we're going to beat ass at the anti-police brutality rally. Like, no, reform is impossible. But talk to me about your thoughts about defund, what that really means. Let's unpack it. And what you see, I mean, do you see a world like without police, where the community polices itself?
Well, I mean, obviously, I am an abolitionist, right? There's a whole bunch of shit that I think we should get away from and do away with. And I really want to see a day where we don't need police with guns in our communities. That's definitely what I want to see. But I also know that we've been trained to call 911 for every problem, every problem. You know, in New York, remember when they introduced 311 and we were like, do what? Like, you mean to tell 311? Why 311? You know, we call 911 for every problem in our households, right? And so we've been trained that way. And I know that in order to help people get away from that mindset, it's going to take time. We're nowhere near a place where we can just get rid of police. That's not even what we're saying. We're talking about creating balance. And that's why I was so ticked off with President Obama, because I felt like he fell right into the trap of being like, well, like you said, your slogan is not good. And we shouldn't be saying defund. And this is a liberal, or he said something like a super progressive term or something. And basically my position was, well, President Obama, what term would you like to use? Okay, make up a new term if that's what people want to do. Who the hell cares about the exact word? If you don't like that word, fine. What I want to know is, do you agree that we should not be putting more money into policing than we do mental health services? Do you agree? Everybody always says, yes, I agree. They do. They do exactly what you're doing. They go, yeah, that's probably, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about creating balance. So if you want to call it the Bobo the Clown on Tuesday, whatever you want to call it, I'm with it. Can we please balance the budget?
The line seems to be reform or defund, right? And defund is posited as like the super lefty end police next to abolition notion. But reform is like, this is the reasonable thing to do.
What I'm saying now, and I talk about it in the book, is overhaul, right? We need the system as it currently is, and I'm not here to tell you anything about history. I'm just looking at the books that you have on the wall, and I'm thinking to myself, I've got so much work to do. And it's funny because there's a part in my book where Nina Simone says that to Angela Davis, and she tells the story of a conversation that she was having with Nina Simone, where Nina was visiting her in prison and was in her cell, because I guess at that time you could go in people's cells, especially if you're a celebrity like Nina Simone. And she saw all the books that Angela Davis had and was like, you read all these books? She said, yeah. And she's like, oh, well, then that shit. Like, I can't go out and speak on behalf of like anything, because I don't know any of that stuff, you know? So anyway, it's a good conversation. But we were talking about the term, right? Overhaul. So my thing is understanding the history of policing. We already know that you can't just reform it because people have been trying that. What we have to do is actually tear down parts of what public safety looks like and rebuild a new thing. That's what we have to do. So if y'all want to call it the rebuild something, whatever. But right now, our priorities, they say your priorities is where your money and your time goes. So our money is clearly going to policing, which means that we have not prioritized public safety that starts within the community. And I know for sure that police in the hood, they don't stop crime. That's not a real thing. They do not. The people who are actually able to stop crime are like Miss Susie, who knows about some drama that's going on, and she's calling mothers or she's pulling over people and, you know, telling them, hey.
The big dog in the neighborhood who's like, you can't attack him.
This is don't ever let me see y'all fighting. Fathers stepping in. The Jacob Blakes of the world who got shot because he went and broke up a fight between young people and was like, I'm taking your ass home. You get in the car. This is done. Like that. That's how violence stops in communities. But if people are going to work or hustling and doing all of these things and don't have resources, they can't focus on that type of work. So I think this is a real, it's not a hard, this is so simple. You know, we know. They just don't want to go up against the police unions.
No, they don't want to go against the police unions. But we have been, the police do a good job at marketing themselves and their necessity, right? Like right now, they're making sure that we know that crime year over year is rocketing up, right? Media conveniently doesn't notice. Like last year, we were all stuck in our home. So of course, crime is up year over year. Because we were all at home last year and now we're like coming back out into the world.
Of course. You know, people are broke. People are emotionally distressed. Maybe whoever was the stabilizing force in their family is now deceased because of COVID. I mean, there's so many different things. And folks haven't, I'll tell you another thing that people don't understand, but I talked to these anti-violence organizers, coordinators, and they said, because people were locked in the house, especially last summer and throughout the year, a lot of online beef started. Like, you know, being on social media, I don't like you, you know, whatever. And now they're going back outside. So they're actually seeing one another for the first time. So there's turf wars and beefs that are like new. So there's just a lot of things. It's a lot of things.
This is not in your book, but I want to dig into this for a second. Are you vaccinated?
Not yet.
Not yet? Are you planning to get vaccinated?
You know, Tori, I watch your page a lot. I read all the content and I'm working on myself. But I come from, so let me just be clear. I come from a family of people who do not vaccinate unless we absolutely have to. So we have like the stuff from when you're young and they tell you, you can't go to school, you can't do this, you can't do that. The measles, the mumps, the chicken pox, whatever, we have that. But in terms of like flu shots and other things, never. My family doesn't do it. We hardly even take medication. Like my parents are all about natural and this, you know, type of thing. So when people start talking about shooting me up, I'm just like, oh my God. And by the way, when I had COVID, it was so bad that for the last several months, like I just got tested for antibodies the other day and I'm still 70%. So I'm not even at a place yet where I have to be vaccinated.
So you had COVID and you're still like, I don't know.
I had it really bad.
And but you're like, I don't know.
I know a lot of Black women that just ain't with it. I be asking them like, did you get COVID? Nope.
And you're still like, I don't know.
And then I have a friend who, you know, her family doesn't want to talk about it publicly, but weeks later, she died.
Not because of the vaccine.
She had a blood clot.
It's extraordinarily rare. Dying from COVID is far, far more common. But okay.
I know died from COVID, just so you know.
We live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door. Thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon. A mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com or wherever books are sold. Lots of people died from COVID.
Some people died just because the system is messed up. Like, some people died because in the beginning, especially, they didn't know what the hell they were doing. They killed people. That happened. Like, people died because of incompetence and lack of information.
I mean, and also people died and were classified as having died of other things, but they wouldn't have died if COVID had not ravaged their system.
That's true. I agree.
Hey peeps, it's your girl, Danielle Moody, host of Woke AF Daily. Every weekday, I'm sounding the alarm and keeping you woke to all the pure evil that is going on in our country. Check me out now at patreon.com/wokeaf. Get 5 new shows every week for just $5 a month. Get woke and stay woke as fuck.
A lot of black, similar to the vaccine, a lot of black people are not, they don't believe in voting. You believe in voting, and you talk about it in your book. And let's start with, I think most of the people who listen to the show believe in voting, but let's talk about why. Because, I mean, even I've had this argument with Mos Def. He's like, no, the government, the system, voting doesn't matter. Let's talk about voting. Why does voting matter? Why should we vote?
I mean, here's what I tell people. If you protest and you don't push for policy, it's just like you missed the mark. Like, we've only done half of the job, right? It's like if you thaw out the meat, you actually have to cook it, right? Because if not, it spoils after a while. It can't just sit there. It has to be something else, another step after you take the meat out the freezer.
The policy is the end result of the protest.
That's the thing. You want the energy that's on the ground matched by whatever happens in your legislative offices. So it's a very simple thing for me. And I tell people, they're like, well, I'm not political. Everything about our lives is political. Literally everything, your cell phone, your sex life. You know, I tell women all the time, like, yo, your vagina is super duper political, right? Because there are people who want to tell you how, what, when, where, when, who.
It used to be illegal to teach us how to read. And you just wrote a book. That's political.
It's political. Everything, your bills, your job, the way you travel, the street lights. So I tell them all the time, you're living a very political life, trying to say that you're not participating in politics, which is exactly why we're not getting the things that we need, because we're not using the political game or playing it the way that we should be. They feel like, well, I voted and I'm done. That's like the worst thing to do.
But okay, we voted. Many of us did vote. Many of us showed up. And because of Detroit and Philadelphia and Atlanta, Joe Biden won.
Right.
We're not yet really getting what we need and deserve out of the system. We might get a police reform bill, but it seems very watered down. We did not get $15 minimum wage, which we, among all people, definitely need. So what do you say to folks who are like, look, many of us did show up and we did not get our cookies?
Yeah, I agree with that 1,000%. But I do know that doing nothing will ensure you get nothing, right? So it's like, you know, you definitely get nothing if you do nothing. But I still believe that there is a different process that I would like for us to follow in terms of when we say, well, we voted. Again, we voted, but then what happens with the organizing, right? Like, how are we organizing power? And moreover, how many of our elected officials understand that power? Because there are people who have to, like, people are like, oh, he signed the Stop Asian Hate bill. And why didn't he sign a bill for us? Well, the bill can't get signed until the people pass it in the two parts of our freaking federal government, right? So the reason why we are not able to get this particular George Floyd Justice and Policing Act the way that it's supposed to be, in my judgment, is two reasons. One, you have somebody like Joe Manchin and his homegirl, I forget the other woman's name, who are supposed to be Democrats, and they are clearly not. So you're dealing with that situation. People are like, well, how do we organize folks in West Virginia? Actually, there are a lot of people that hit me up that are in West Virginia that want to be organized, but there's so many people who don't see West Virginia as a place to go to get on the ground to do the work. So we have to think about that as organizers, and that's a failure of me and others like me. But the other problem is that you have people like Jim Clyburn, who I love as a human being, but I don't need you to be out there providing cover for the Republicans. Need you to be quiet. Need you not to go out after your particular, after the House, rather, has already passed the bill with ending qualified immunity, right? They did that. You made that happen. So why the hell are you talking in the midst of the Senate negotiations, other than to say to Chuck Schumer, go get your job done. We did our part. Now it's time for you to do yours. How can I support you, Cory Booker? How can I support? Like, instead, he's out here providing cover. So then for me, it makes my job really hard. And I've been arguing with my elder friends for the last few days because they're like, well, you know, it's a process. I'm like, people are they're tired of hearing it's a process. They're tired of hearing compromise. So now when it's time for me to go back and try to get people to vote again, they're going to be like, don't come talk to me. And I may not be able to talk to them, Tori. I may not.
I think that one of the biggest problems in the Black community is the war on drugs. It opens up so much of the relationship with the police that leads to these traumatic incidents. You know, stop and frisk is a big gateway into the war on drugs. The policing, the prosecution, the incarceration, so much of it comes from, well, I thought he had drugs. I smelled drugs. That's why I stopped his car. That's why I went into the building. That's why I went to his house. The end of the war on drugs, or at least just the legalization of marijuana, would go a long way toward getting us one step toward some sort of freedom.
I agree. And in New York, we've done it. Right. And there's still more work to be done. But not only does our bill legalize marijuana, it also deals with expungement of records of people who've been locked up. Right. So there are efforts happening around the country. But again, when we look at the federal government, it's pitiful. I don't have an excuse for it. It's really sad that it doesn't matter what we do. There seems to be these roadblocks. And when you're looking at people like Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, these people have more power than they should have. That's just
it's going to be a state by state issue, right? It's not a federal.
But it should be. It can be. There are proposals, like when you think about the BREATHE Act, if you will, there are proposals out there to get the federal government to provide incentives for local governments to let people out, at least the expungement piece, right? But yes, it is true that in order to legalize marijuana, it is state by state because they have all the different rules for, you know, how you grow it, how you buy it, how you, all those things. But the expungement piece is something that people are trying to get the federal government to do. And Obama was trying to do it. I mean, we have to, you got to give him that he literally was trying to let out as many people as possible. And then he was, you know, it was stopped.
But we have to release people on a state level. Are we ever going to see any sort of justice for Breonna Taylor?
Kristen Clark is now the head of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. Hopefully she will investigate Breonna Taylor's situation and also the police department there. Now the FBI is already investigating the police department, which is super duper corrupt, but it's not unlike many of the other police departments across the nation. And so hopefully those two things will result in there being federal charges brought against those officers and the LMPD. Hopefully, you know, if the question is, does her family believe that or are they hopeful? They are hopeful, but really beaten down.
For more from me and Tamika, join us over at patreon.com/Toure Show. Thanks so much to Tamika for a great interview, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to our super producers, Britt, Marcus Harkis, Noel, Sam Montes, Jason Reynolds, Gerville Calais, Michelle, Brenda Cox, Kathy F., Dr. Keena Murphy, Earl Dorsey, and Theo Tokas. Toure Show gives you fuel to power your dreams because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. You can find me on Twitter at Toure and on Instagram at Toure Show and on Patreon at patreon.com/Toure Show. And check out my newsletter, Black Minds Matter. Go to blackmindsmatter.substack.com. Toure Show is written by me, Toure, and produced by Jackie Garofano. Our editor is Ryan Woodhall. Our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shanta Covington. Our booker is Claudia Jean. And we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we will be back on Friday and on Wednesday with more amazing guests because the man can't shut us down.